Butter by BTS, as we discuss the success of K-pop on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. K-pop is mainstream music from South Korea exported to the world. We're exploring the rise of this cultural force. And notable this year, by the way, recent reporting by the English version of the South Korean national newspaper, more than 25 million K-pop albums were sold in the first half of this year, highest ever album sales for the period in a decade. K-pop megastars like BTS, among the top five most viewed music artists on YouTube. What do you love about K-pop? How long you've been a fan? 800-642-1234. Asia Romano is a culture staff writer for Vox. Asia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Explain the force of K-pop here in the U.S. How popular is it?
Well, I think it might depend on who you ask, but certainly the U.S. is one of the countries that I think has really, really embraced K-pop in terms of global audience. There are millions and millions of K-pop fans here in the U.S., and they're very, very enthusiastic. You often only hear about them when they're making the news for things like last year's Donald Trump rally, where K-pop fans basically kind of stormed the castle and kept actual rally attendees from attending. And so things like that tend to be what gets all the news and makes all the headlines. But I think K-pop fandom in general is very, very enthusiastic, very dynamic, and full of lots of people you might not expect.
So permeating politics there. But why do people love it?
Well, I think if you've ever listened to K-pop, the K-pop that when we talk about K-pop, we are really talking about a specific strand of Korean pop music. And that's the kind that comes from what we call idol groups and idol artists that are basically recruited, trained, and prepped for lives on the stage in studios. So I actually compare it to like the Mickey Mouse Club of the late 90s, where you had early stars like Justin Timberlake, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, were all in the Mickey Mouse Club and basically were scouted very early in their preteens, trained to become put on television, trained to perform for audiences, and basically groomed for lives as pop stars, and then basically unleashed onto the world. That's exactly what happens in these studios. And as part of the whole package, they train for hours, they spend hours every day dancing, rehearsing choreography, polishing their routines, polishing their images. It's very, very regimented and systematized. And as part of that, you get songs that are very, very upbeat, very, very catchy, designed to be immediately accessible to the world at large, right? You don't necessarily need to know Korean to have a K-pop song earwormed in your head for weeks. And so I think that's a major part of the appeal. These songs are very, very good. They're very, they feel very modern and contemporary. They're very here now, and they're often very, very catchy and just won't leave your head forever.
Isha, what do you make, though, of K-pop stars perpetuating that expectation to live up to impossible standards, that pressure to be perfect and that intensity? What is going on there?
Well, I think most people realize that they don't just get there overnight because K-pop stars, again, are scouted very young. People are very aware that they spend years basically in these kind of grueling regimented systems learning how to be the best that they can be. So I think if anything, people tend to see them as sources of inspiration because they look at they can honestly see their hard work. They can see them improving over time in many cases. In Korea, competition shows are very, very popular, and weekly competition shows where K-pop stars basically go through this routine of competing every week to be the top ranked K-pop group or K-pop artist that week. And so even though they're pop stars and they're giving off this image of perfection, they're still competing and learning and growing along with everybody else. And I think that that really kind of softens that image a little bit.
We're discussing the rise of K-pop with Asia Romano, who's a culture staff writer for Vox. You can join in. Are you a fan of BTS? Maybe Blackpink or the girl group Twice? What are your favorite K-pop groups? Join in 800-642-1234. you know, I'm wondering, what is the situation around sexism and misogyny in K-pop, and especially for these girl groups? Because, you know, there are like three dominant companies in this genre that really dominate the industry.
Mm-hmm. So I think this has gotten more attention over time. And I think women in K-pop have become more emboldened to speak out against maybe social pressure and systemic pressure in the industry over time. And I think that that's helped a lot. Also, girl bands in K-pop tend to be marketed not to men, but to other girls, which may not be what you might expect, but they're really, there really is, especially in the, what we call the third and fourth generation, the most recent, eras of K-pop, there's been an emphasis on girl power, on feminine solidarity and women supporting each other. And I think has come a long way in terms of eradicating a lot of those stereotypes and a lot of those problems.
Well, let's get to some music here, and starting off with BTS's hit songs Dynamite and Butter. But actually, no, let's listen to their breakout song from 2016, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Asia, what did you hear in this breakout?
I think it's a really, it's a good example of BTS as a as an individual band. And it's also a really good example of K-pop as a whole, because you have these individual parts where every part is kind of distinctly catchy on its own, if that makes sense. And put together, they make a really compelling through line throughout the song. So you're sort of learning more about the song as you go. You know, every couple of bars, you get a new musical idea that's just as interesting as the one before it, right? I also think for BTS, this idea of blood, sweat, and tears is sort of central to their branding in a way, because they're very much about giving this presentation of authenticity, of struggle, of challenge, and overcoming obstacles. And that has a heavy appeal for their fan base.
Who writes these songs? Who has control of the creative process in K-pop?
Well, it really depends. The more successful a band is, I think generally the more autonomy their members will have over the things that they create and produce. Often members will be very musically accomplished. For example, with BTS, most of the members have they play various musical instruments. They've all had a hand in writing songs and producing songs. Some of them have entirely separate standalone careers as solo artists. And so, so like on their most recent album, several of them contributed directly to the album by writing songs and producing behind the scenes.
So the members of these bands do have a say, perhaps in more of that creative element of what is catchy and trying to define what the sound is of K-pop.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that often gets overlooked when we talk about K-pop. I think, a lot of people tend to kind of assume that it's sort of like a machine produced, right? Like in a lab, but it's a lot more organic than that. And like, even somebody like Psy, who of course went viral for Gangnam Style in 2012, like he actually trained at Berklee here in the US before he embarked on his career in K-pop. So I think there's a lot of real, there's a lot of real serious talent that goes into this beyond just singing and dancing. And that's something that often gets overlooked.
Asia Romano, she watches closely K-pop as the culture staff writer for Vox. What do you think about K-pop's cultural influence in America and the world? Are you a K-pop collector? Do you collect albums and photo cards of K-pop stars? What about the fandom and digital activism? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, talk more here on the Ideas Network. Lovesick Girls by Blackpink, the top-selling K-pop girl group of 2020, as we discuss the rise of Korean pop music, K-pop, through time. BTS, those three letters, they've swept across the world, turned members of the boy band into today's pop icons. Do you listen to K-pop? What attracts you to the music? Who are your favorite artists? 800-642-1234. Asia Romano is a culture staff writer for Vox and has reported on K-pop. She stays with us. So Asia, step way back into history. Where did K-pop even start? Where did it come from?
So actually, K-pop began in a specific moment in time, basically with this, again, I mentioned earlier that K-pop, basically, like, there are a lot of competition shows in Korea. And so during one of those competition shows, back in the late 80s, a band called Sal Taji and Boys performed a hip-hop song called Come Back Home, and it was extremely popular. They actually lost the competition show, but they were an immediate hit, and they were the song was a bestseller, and this actually created sort of a new industry around the idea that that K-pop could basically, that Korean pop music could basically be more mainstream and more contemporary, and ushered in the era of what I mentioned before, the studios, right? So you had these two or three major studios that began essentially routinizing the scouting and training of K-pop stars. And so all of that happened in the late 90s, basically. And so by the 2000s, you started seeing bands like Super Junior and DBSK that were marketed both in Korea and also overseas in places like Japan. And this was all actually part of a larger cultural strategy that had also begun in the late 80s and 90s that became known as Hallyu, the Korean Wave. And it was essentially a government-sponsored mission to turn Korea's focus as a turn Korea's focus on the global stage away from exporting industry resources and turning it more towards exporting soft power, by which I mean cultural exports. So things like movies, things like gaming, and things like music, of course. So K-pop really was sort of the driving, the central focus of this larger movement. And we have seen it over the decades, as we've seen, you know, the exporting of Korean movies become very popular, like Korean revenge thrillers, Korean horror, and of course, films like Parasite, which won the Best Picture Oscar last year. So, so we've seen this happen in a number of ways, but really K-pop has been at the center of it.
Yeah, so Sal Taji and Boys, they really hit a nerve, and here they are performing I Know back in 1992. So Asia, when you hear that, do you hear the evolution of the genre?
Well, obviously, if you listen to that music, you probably immediately pick up on what seems like really obvious elements of Black hip hop culture here in the U.S. And this was something that early K-pop was very, very, very heavily influenced by and continues to be heavily influenced by. And this is a source of ongoing discussion and debate within K-pop fandom and within criticism of K-pop. You know, how much are they appropriating Black American culture, basically? And it's a very kind of a fraught subject, but you can hear it, obviously, in the music. You can hear that sounds very much like, you know, like Run DMC or something, right? Like you can hear a direct musical influence in the way that K-pop songs are arranged and produced. And that's pretty much carried through to till today. But also, like, if you imagine K-pop or Korean pop music in the late 80s at that point was mostly a mix of traditional Korean trot music and also like more like mainstream pop, but mainstream pop from like the 70s, really. Mm. like like not something that was that contemporary, right? And certainly not something that was maybe that that direct and that overt. And also what Sao Taji brought to that performance was obviously the dancing too, which you can't really see on the like the radio,
sure,
but
yeah, the
but dance,
choreography, yeah.
right? And dancing is a major part of K-pop and the way that it gets marketed and distributed, because people are coming not just for the songs, but for the videos that go along with the songs and for the choreography that go along with that goes along with the songs. And actually in around 2010, a band called SHINee introduced the concept of releasing rehearsal videos for their choreography along with their videos, their actual music videos, which became kind of standard in the industry. So now people not only get to watch the dance, but then they get to watch basically like an unedited, you know, not shot together, not composite, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just a video of the boys and or the girls in the room in a room in a practice room in a studio just dancing the entire dance, like full stop. So you can see all the choreography and you can learn it and do it home at home. So I think there's an element of interactivity too there.
I want to get more into the dancing and choreography in just a moment, but stepping back for a moment, when you look at K-pop today, does it have problems with cultural appropriation and racial insensitivity? And is it addressing that in some way?
I think yes and no. It's pretty contextual and it depends on the band and it depends on sort of the what role the band has, how powerful are they. We've had definite moments in the past where K-pop really unthinkingly used Black culture and appropriated Black culture in ways that were offensive. Everything from blackface to, you know, depictions of K-pop band members wearing dreadlocks and things like that. This continues to be a problem to some extent, but I think because K-pop fandom has gotten more global and K-pop members of K-pop fandom have gotten much more, they've gotten much better, not better, but they've gotten much more visible in terms of addressing the problem and calling out the problem. More bands and more artists are aware of it and have taken to addressing it themselves and calling out, you know, the need for the industry to change and be more responsible.
Asia Romano is with us, culture staff writer for Vox, as we discuss the staying power of K-pop around the world. With your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Let's listen to the 2009 hit G by Girls' Generation. You mentioned the dancing and choreography, and now, you know, you can start to see it in your head when you listen to the music.
Right. I literally was just sitting here doing the GGG dance along with the song. That song is a great example of choreography that really almost sticks in your head with the music, because that dance was iconic at the time. A lot of K-pop dances are designed to be repeatable, you know, doable by people at home. So they're simple moves combined with very tricky, tight, you know, footwork and body work. So you get kind of a bit of everything. And I think that song is a really great example of that. You have very, very definite, easy to remember gestures in that song. And of course, you have 9 amazing female artists performing it very seamlessly and fluidly. So it packs a wall up.
Yeah, so there's like this aspiration of what you want to see out of the choreography and everyone aspiring to get those moves down just so.
Right.
And again, it kind of comes around to that perfectionist tendency.
And I think also just the idea that if you can rehearse enough and do the dance, then, you know, it's not like that perfection is attainable, right? Like there are all kinds of videos on YouTube where dancers repeat this choreography, you know, and do it in their own ways. There are, you know, TikTok dance challenges where people attempt to, you know, do the dances at home on their own. And I think K-pop is really kind of one reason that K-pop has been so successful is because it does work very well, you know, in an internet age where things are very, very interactive and everything feels very collectivized, right?
Yeah. Asia Romano is a culture staff writer for Vox, covering K-pop and its worldwide influence. When did you discover K-pop? Do you appreciate BTS, or what is your favorite K-pop group? Join in on K-pop 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Asia Romano after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Permission to Dance by BTS, as we discuss the global phenomenon of K-pop. Megagroup BTS has teamed up with YouTube to launch the Permission to Dance Challenge. Will you do it? It's people around the world recording and sharing their 15-second version of BTS's music video for their new single called Permission to Dance. Contest runs through mid-August. You can join in. What do you love about K-pop choreography? What is so catchy about the music? 800-642-1234. Asia Romano is at the intersection of K-pop and culture at Vox and with us for the hour. Let's bring in Lily now in Milwaukee. Hi, Lily. What are your thoughts on K-pop?
Hi. Well, so I started listening to K-pop, probably around 2010, definitely in the second generation. And I feel second generation through third generation, a lot of people I know were fans of many different groups. But, when I talk to people who are just getting into K-pop, they're very passionate about one group, sometimes even creating fan wars. And so I was kind of wondering if there was any insight on that.
On the fan wars themselves?
Well, fan wars are just kind of what the difference is between, second gen, third gen fans versus fourth gen fans.
Yeah. Asia.
Yes, I kind of am in the same position. I started listening to K-pop actually through Japanese pop music in the early aughts, 2005-ish. And I really, really got into K-pop more broadly around 2008, 2009, when I also started listening to many different groups. And to me, the focus was on the music more so than the individual artists involved in those groups. And I think for that sort of reflects a lot of people's journey back then. And I think to some degree, the change in fandom over the last decade or so isn't just in K-pop, and it reflects a larger trend fueled by social media to some extent of tribalism on the internet in general, if that makes sense, right? Like everyone sees themselves as part of an identity group. And in many cases in K-pop fandom, that that identity group is what band you like the best. Does that make sense?
Hmm. Lily, are you still there?
Yep.
Yeah.
No, that was really interesting. And I definitely agree. I think social media has had a part to play in all this.
What have you been?
I also want to say that I think it's down to marketing too. I think with BTS, we really see an emphasis change from marketing the music and the dance, to marketing the sort of a narrative about the band, right? And a narrative about these artists as individuals and as a collective entity in the band. And I think when you play on those emotions, you get a different sort of response from fans, and you get fans feeling very protective about their individual faves. And that, I think, also lends itself to this sort of tribalism.
Hmm. Lily, what have you been listening to recently with K-pop?
I'm just starting to kind of learn some of the newer groups or somewhat newer groups. I've been listening to a lot of the bands like Onewee and Day6, but my first love was and always will be SHINee.
Asia, do you have any recommendations for Lily?
Oh, well, I actually have been getting into Stray Kids a bit recently, some ATEEZ. I think you really can't go wrong with any of the third and fourth generation bands, honestly. I think they're doing a lot of innovative things. And my recommendation is just to, you know, check out a few Spotify playlists and so forth, see what you like. Talk to different fans from different fandoms and see, you know, what they're listening to that's new, you know? I know, especially if you're in a fandom for a specific band, it might feel kind of disloyal to just to go further afield, but I think you'll experience a lot of new music that way.
Lily, thanks so much. We heard from Jean, who wrote in to say the band Hot, H-O-T, was the biggest K-pop band back in the early 2000s, selling out stadiums in South Korea. And Jean says, I never have heard anyone mention them, but I feel like they are an important cornerstone to modern K-pop. And their song Candy is fantastic and still covered by other K-pop bands today. Your thoughts on Hot?
Absolutely. They actually were the first idol group. So they were formed by the man who founded one of the big studios, SM. And I think they were essentially designed to be what K-pop would eventually become, you know, a group of I think it was five members of HOT who were basically designed to be marketed as a collective unit of idols performing and dancing together. And that was the first time that had really been done. And they were so successful that they really created a template for what came after.
Your recent article for Vox, and you posed this question, why aren't American radio stations playing more K-pop? What did you learn?
Well, I actually learned a lot when I was reporting that article, not only about K-pop on the radio, but about things like the various factors and issues that go into how radio programmers decide what music to put on air and why, and what, and it's really, really, it was fascinating. I talked to a lot of experts who had lots of different insights. And the reason that the article came about is because I was just researching statistics for BTS, because I wanted to see whether BTS had continued to get as much radio play as they did when Dynamite first came out. Because when Dynamite first came out, as I'm sure you remember, it was everywhere. The bottom line, the short answer is yes, they have, but it's still nothing compared to what English language artists get. So for example, BTS has now had 5 straight number one hits in a row, which is amazing. But of those 5 straight number one hits, you know, Permission to Dance is currently number one this week, right? But Permission to Dance is probably getting played on the radio 50% as much as the song that's in the number 2 slot. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And BTS is getting far and just by orders of magnitude, BTS is getting much more play than every other K-pop artist in existence. And when you look at the statistics for the last year, they're just staggering. So you go from like BTS, who I think most people have heard of, to Blackpink, which is, as you said, the most successful girl band in K-pop right now. And so, excuse me. Over the last year, say BTS maybe got 170,000 total plays on the air, which is pretty decent. BTS got around probably 19,000, which is much lower. But it's still, you know, significant, 19,000. And we're talking about mainstream top 40 stations here, right? But then you go to the third most popular band in the list twice. And I think they got a total of, what did they get? It was something, they got 38 plays.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. 38 plays across 8 radio stations.
Basically, and most, nothing. Yeah.
Right. And most of those radio stations were college radio stations for the entire year. So, and everything else after that is just, you know, further downhill from there. So it's really staggering to think about, how much music you're not hearing on the radio, even though this music is extremely, extremely popular.
We're talking with Vox culture journalist Asia Romano, who is explaining how K-pop resonates around the globe and the limitations of it. You can join in 800-642-1234. Lee is with us from Madison. Hi, Lee.
Hi, I was not really a fan of K-pop before the pandemic. I was kind of aware of like it was a thing, but once the pandemic hit, I kind of fell down the rabbit hole first with Dynamite and it went from there. And I really love it, but there's one thing in particular that I've always kind of been confused by, and it has sort of made me uncomfortable, and that is the K-pop industry's sort of weird obsession and exploitation of Black culture. It seems to be they kind of mass market it without crediting, you know, where it comes from and the original creators, whether it be dancing or songs or styling. And I just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Absolutely. It is a problem and it continues to be a problem. I think there's always a fine line when you're talking about appropriation, whether it's appropriation versus homage, right? And in some cases, bands that have you know, basically collaborated with various artists and have tried to, you know, to get permission to, say, sample or remix a pre-existing song, right, will be accused of plagiarism or accused of appropriation when they necessarily aren't. And it's more like a collaborative effort to homage the original. But in general, with K-pop, what you're getting is, you're absolutely right, what you're seeing is a lot of appropriation and a lot of really irresponsible and often insensitive remixing and copying without really a lot of effort to credit, as you said, back to the original artists. And I think this is something that continues to be very, very hotly debated within fan culture. But because it is being more hotly debated, and because people, especially Black members of K-pop fandom, are more visible now than they were just a couple of years ago, these issues have become more prominent and more well known. I think it's really significant that you're talking about it now, and you've only been in the fandom for a couple of years, right? So this is something that was really apparent to you and part of the discussion of your and part of your K-pop experience. So I think that says both good things and bad things for how the conversation is evolving. It's clear that there's a lot more work to be done in this space.
Asia, how much of a group's success is dependent on a dedicated fan base, and how do those fans interact with each other?
Oh, that's a really tricky question. I mean, K-pop would not be where it is today if it weren't for the fans. There's a very, I think, delicate interplay between a group's marketing and a group's fan base, because fans are being given, like I said earlier, specific narratives and specific, you know, incentives to feel themselves, you know, becoming part of a collective. And in BTS's case, the narrative was always one of uphill struggle and an uphill battle that the fans were basically involved in with the artists. And so whenever BTS scored a number one on the Billboard Hot 100, that was a victory for the fans as well. And it's something that has really continued to be the case. I think fans increasingly see themselves as integral to an artist's success or failure. And they really are. But of course, like I said, tribalism, the increasing polarization of society in general on the internet leads to a lot of tension. Especially even within K-pop fandom, even if you're a member of the fandom, if you attempt to criticize anything about the band, that often other fans will respond with immediate backlash and intense harassment. And in fact, we saw this a lot last year when K-pop fans began to support Black Lives Matter movement. They were still simultaneously often viciously harassing members of color in their own fandoms when those fans of color tried to talk about, you know, perceived racism in the industry, cultural appropriation, and other issues within the industry and within the fandom. So it's really a double-edged sword, because you have fans that are trying to be, and from the outside probably look very unified and very collective, but within fandoms there's often a lot of internal fighting.
Vox culture reporter Asia Romano, she's with us on the rise and the staying power of K-pop. What barriers the genre faces in the U.S. and around the globe? What do you think is holding K-pop back? What do you not like about K-pop, or what keeps you from listening to it? Is it the language barrier? What influences do you hear when you listen to K-pop? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Asia Romano here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. Japanese-American cartoonist and illustrator Sam Nakashira recently drew a comic about the origins of K-pop for Vox. And these artists, they've created an army of fans. It's not all positive, though. The genre has had to address exploitative contracts. Nakashira talked about this with NPR.
The power is held in monopolies, where there's just like a few large corporations that have a lot of power over their artists and also over the medium in general.
What concerns you about K-pop and gender and social norms? The ascent of K-pop stars? Are you inspired to explore Korean art and culture through K-pop? 800-642-1234. Asia Romano of Vox is with us for about 9 more minutes. Asia, you know, you're seeing new band pop up after new group. You know, 26 in 2021, there were dozens last year. Why are there so many coming onto the scene?
I think, you know, it's supply and demand. It's basic principle of capitalism to some extent. You know, there's such an interest in K-pop. And I think for many K-pop fans, there's this sense that Hallyu, the aforementioned Korean wave, has sort of reached its peak. Hmm. But I think here in the U.S., that's not really the case. You know, for many people, they're just experiencing K-pop for the first time. And I think now there's really a push to kind of, now that people have sort of figured out how to market to the U.S. to some extent, and across the globe, there's an interest in doing that to scale, if that makes sense. And so I think all the new bands that you're seeing are part of that. And I think it also reflects just how much interest there is in becoming a K-pop star. Mm-hmm. People really, really want to go through those rigorous training routines and systems.
How do groups stand out in such a competitive marketplace?
I wish I knew. I think there's sort of an indefinable magic quality that has to happen there. But I think also because the people who get put in those groups are scouted very carefully, and they're trained very carefully, and they're put on stage almost incrementally over the years before they're eventually put into a K-pop group. Much care is taken to make sure that you get the right chemistry. You know, every artist has to be individually compelling, but also has to have tons of chemistry with their bandmates, right? So there's, I think it's sort of a kind of just a magical combination of luck.
Stars aligning.
Right, yeah.
You are a fan of Wang Yibo, and let's listen to just a bit of Wugan. So Wang is an actor, a dancer, a singer, a rapper, a motorcycle racer. Is there anything Wang can't do?
There really, really isn't. He hasn't tried mountain climbing yet, but I think that's probably next in the list. And he actually was, so he's Chinese. He's a Chinese artist, and many K-pop artists are actually from China. And he trained in Korea to become a K-pop artist after being scouted in China. But then in 2016, China basically banned K-pop, which threw many K-pop bands into upheaval, and his band was one of them. And he's since become very, very famous, extremely famous in China as a solo artist, which is interesting to think about, because had he stayed in Korea, he probably would have been just another one of those kind of middle of the road, indistinguishable artists in an indistinguishable K-pop band, right? Yeah. So this question of how you stand out, I think, is really prominent and relevant in his case.
Well, it makes me also think of North Korea and Kim Jong-un, who attended a performance of Red Velvet and then went on to say he was deeply moved by the performance, and then last month called K-pop a vicious cancer. So what are the politics around that?
You know, I think it's very, very difficult to say because obviously I think North Korea has a vested interest in trying to claim any South Korean success as being to some extent their own, right? Mm-hmm. And a reflection of the inherent greatness of Korea, but also K-pop to, I'm not going to speak for Kim Jong-un. I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but if I had to speculate, I would assume that to some degree, he sees K-pop as being very heavily influenced by the US and Western culture, which it is. And so therefore he also has to put distance between North Korea and that entire industry.
How long do you think South Korea can ride this cultural wave and in promoting K-pop?
Well, how long has the US ridden its cultural wave, right? Like all you need, you need talent and you need creativity and you need the ability to export your vision to around the world. And Korea has certainly proven that it can do all of that. And I think increasingly we're seeing many, many global industries, you know, not just Korea, but, you know, Europe, if you think of like Eurovision, Chinese action, you know, action blockbusters, Japan with anime, or we're seeing all different kinds of cultural exports overseas gain traction, gain visibility, and gain international fan bases, which I think is gradually shifting the emphasis away from Hollywood as like the be all end all of creative excellence in around the, you know, in the globe.
What is the next generation? I mean, I keep going back to what Lily was saying about listening to the earlier generations, but where is K-pop headed?
This is a really, really interesting question. And I think for me, I think K-pop is headed towards a more individualistic view of idols and a view of the industry. Gradually over time, you mentioned slave contracts earlier, which is mm-hmm. very, very, very strict requirements that K-pop artists have to live up to when they're in the industry and when they're in these groups. Over time, those have basically become watered down and become basically they're no longer imprisoned in this horribly abusive system. They have a lot more freedom and a lot more individual creative self-expression. And I think especially because bands like BTS and Blackpink have really begun to show how you can push these individualized narratives to fans that then respond with increased emotional intensity. I think we're going to see more and more of that individualism take center stage.
Asia, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. This has been great.
Asia Romano is a culture staff writer for Vox. We have a link, by the way, to her recent piece on K-pop at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.